And welcome to radio station KPFT HD2 channel. And on the internet, kpft.org, link to Execution Watch. Execution Watch itself, an independent website, and from a link on theprisonshow.org, I am Ray Hill. And it is Wednesday, November the 12th. And there is a scheduled execution of George H. Whitaker III. Whitaker, 36 years old, was convicted of going on a shooting spree at his ex-girlfriend's house in Crosby. She had broken up with him and killing her 16-year-old sister and seriously wounding her mother and another sister. Mr. Whitaker's conviction and death sentence for the 1994 murder of Shakitha Carrier was upheld by the Courts of Appeals. The Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles unanimously rejected clemency petition, saying that his sentence, asking that his sentence be commuted to life in prison. As far as we know, the process will go through its usual this evening. We have with us, of course, our in-house legal analyst, Jim Skelton. Are we going to get Dave Atwood on before I get Jim on? The producer has come in, and we are going to reroute to Dave Atwood. Dave Atwood is at the Houston Vigil, which is over here on South Main. I hope that one doesn't get rained out. We've been having rains all day. And we do not tonight have a reporter from Huntsville. However, producer Elizabeth Stein has made arrangements to talk to TDCJ Public Information Officer Jason Clark a little after the bottom of the hour when he should have returned to his office. And so we're getting Dave on the line even as we speak.
Dave, can you hear me?
And let's see.
Yeah, hang on. I'll put you on the speaker.
And so Dave is coming up momentarily. And hello, Dave? Dave?
Messed that up.
Okay, well, sorry. We're going to do that again. Why don't I just go ahead and get Jim to analyze it? We got Dave, are you there?
Yeah, I'm there. Speak up, though, Ray.
Okay, I'll do the best that I can. And
okay.
You're running a little hot, so, and I'm running a little cold, so we'll work this out. Dave, where are you?
I'm down at the corner of Maine and by the museum.
Maine and Benz.
Right, Maine and Benz, we're having our vigil.
Okay, how many folks are there?
We've got about, tonight we've got about 8 people here, which is not a big group, but, you know, it's never a big group down here, not normally anyway.
Well, it could be worse. You could be having more weather than you're having.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Dave, what makes folks come to that location in Houston every time there's an execution? Because there's sometimes 2 or 3 people, sometimes 8 or 10 people, sometimes more.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of it is, this is a convenient location for people who can't, you know, the preferred location is always Huntsville. We always tell people that. That's where the killing is taking place, and if people can go there, they should go there. The people that come here are the people who just, for whatever reason, work or whatever, can't make it to Huntsville that day. And so sometimes we have a larger group, and sometimes we have a smaller group, just depending on schedules and what's going on. And even the particular case sometimes will people will feel they have to go to Huntsville for this particular one, and sometimes they don't. So.
And generally speaking, the appearance is about the issue rather than the individual, because some of these folks have volunteered to be executed. Some of these folks are have some kind of not too pretty cases, and some of these folks are many folks believed to be not guilty of the crime itself.
Yeah, and there's such a variety between cases, and I would say, looking at this group that are here today, which is a mix, pretty good mix of people, that most of the people are here because they just oppose the idea of the state taking human life when it's totally unnecessary to do so. And so even regardless of the details of the case, they're not for the death penalty. They don't think this is a good response by the state to crime.
Well, and recently the organization that you're active in has been to Austin to look at legislative package for the upcoming session, and what happened this week was the first date that bills could be filed. What's going on?
Well, I know that we're going to be, every year there is an abolition bill. There are lots of other bills that are filed, too, that have to do with the Criminal Justice Committee, the criminal justice system. Like, for instance, you know, Senator Ellis always introduces bills. I read today again that he will introduce a bill again on an innocence commission and certain bills to make eyewitness identification better, confessions, improve the, you know, taping the confessions and things like that, which are all very important improvements of the criminal justice system, all of which we support taking place. And usually, of course, they're much easier. Not that anything is easy in Texas, but they would be easier to get through than a bill to abolish the death penalty. But we always will introduce a bill to abolish the death penalty. We have done it in the past on moratorium bills, which are also will probably be introduced again this session, although the Texas coalition, that we're really focusing on abolition, because we understand that, as strange as it may sound, it might be easier to get an abolition bill through.
Well, I know you've previously tried the moratorium effort. Is that based on some rationale for a moratorium?
Well, the whole thing on the moratorium was focused on stopping executions while the whole criminal justice system is studied to ensure that we don't put innocent people, to death. Now, that is still got a lot of validity to it, the whole idea of a moratorium, although it's not abolition. Our ultimate goal is abolition. If we could have a moratorium on executions in Texas, we would support that 100%.
Sure.
And we have in the past. But the legislative system that we have in the, what the governor can do and what the governor can't do makes it difficult to get a moratorium in Texas. Even maybe more difficult than getting abolition of the death penalty, the way the system is set up. So we have decided to really focus on our ultimate goal, which is abolition of the death penalty. If a moratorium bill is introduced, we will obviously support that too, because we would support a moratorium as we support all bills to improve the criminal justice system.
Dave,
our ultimate goal is abolition.
If any folks listening to this live or in archive want to get involved in the legislative process of your organization, how best to reach you?
I would go to the Texas Coalition website, which is www.tcadp.org. www.tcadp.org. That's the best way to get involved with our organization. We've got a lot of information on there, not only on what's going to be coming up on the legislature, but also educational programs, contacts that we have throughout the state. For instance, you know, we have groups in a number of the cities. We have, if we don't have a chapter someplace, we may have a representative in that city. And so people really from all over, not only Houston area, but all over Texas can somehow get tied into what's going on and do their part. We really need people to be, we need to grow the organization, whether it's our organization or another organization that's working against the death penalty. And we have a number of them in Texas. We need to get people involved. They have to understand that the death penalty is totally unnecessary. It's bad for this state. It's expensive. It gives the state a terrible reputation. And there's two ways that this could end up, Ray. One is that something could happen through the Supreme Court that would stop executions. Another, which is, in my estimation, also very difficult. Both ways are difficult at this time. but would be a bill in Texas that would stop executions just in this state. And so it could be done nationwide through the Supreme Court, or it could be a statewide initiative. And I think, quite frankly, that we're seeing changes. You know, this last election, the makeup of the legislature changed. I think the citizens of the state are getting a heck of a lot more educated. I really think the death penalty is being promoted more by the politicians that support it more than the people at this time, because we do have life without parole. That's not a particularly popular option with a lot of people, too, because it's very draconian to put a person in prison for the rest of their life, and no matter how much they improve themselves, are rehabilitated, they're stuck there. That's terrible, but it is an option that we now have to the death penalty.
Dave Atwood, we appreciate you joining us. We do not actually have a correspondent online for the demonstration in Huntsville. However, Elizabeth is due to hear from a public information officer, TDCJ, to tell us whether or not the process was completed as scheduled.
Okay, right.
So we'll be back in touch with you. Give our regards to the folks showing up there.
Sure will, Ray, and thank you for everything you do.
Thank you, sir. And that was Dave Atwood with Texas Coalition to abolish the death penalty. And their website, again, is www.tcabp.org. Jim, you were able to find out a good bit of information about this case. What turned up?
Well, this is one of those cases unlike we've had before where there's very little doubt about guilt. What had happened, Whitaker had met this lady, and Katina was her name, Katina Whitaker, and had met her in high school, and apparently they formed a friendship back when she was in high school. And then later on, after both of them get out of school, they start dating and living together. Their only problem was Whitaker happened to be married at the time, had two children. And he and his wife were separated, and he moved in with his girlfriend, Katina. And they lived together, and the opinion itself, and I read the opinion of the Court of Criminal Appeals, didn't state how long they lived together, but it was apparently somewhat stormy, because during the relationship, after they started living together, apparently, according to her, he became very possessive, physically and mentally abused her, and she became frightened of him. And so what happened is, a guy once said she got rid of 10 years of work in one night. So what happened? She was working, and what she did, she got him to drop her off at work, and then while he was at work, she gets her friend, she goes back to the house and afraid of him, and moves most of her things out and moves in with her friend.
The kids were living with her, too?
Well, it doesn't say. This is the girlfriend. Remember, he separated from his wife with two children. They apparently had no children between them two. So what happens, she goes back to her house and gets all of her things, some of her things, and moves out, and she hides out. And apparently she doesn't tell her family where she's living, because she's heading out. She's worried that Whitaker will find... In fact, she wouldn't even go to work. She was worried that if he found her at work or at home, he would do something to her. Now, this happened in April of 1994. And apparently he was looking for her, and couldn't find her, and was unsuccessful in trying to locate her. And during this interim, what he did, he told a friend of his shortly before the shooting that he was going to kill somebody. In fact, he said, "You won't see me again because I'm going to kill somebody." And then what happened on the day that the shooting occurred, and this is just almost bizarre beyond words, he goes by and picks up his separated wife, the wife he separated from. They had two children. He picked up both of those two children. His wife had a child by prior marriage, a 9-year-old child. So he picks up his wife, who he separated from, their two children, and they pick up the 9-year-old, I guess, stepchild, for want of a better phrase. And then they drop by and pick up a friend of his. So there are two adults and three kids in the car. And he tells them at least what their supposed mission was, to take some of his girlfriend's clothing back to her parents' house. So they drive over toward the parents' house, and on the way over there, he gets his wife to drive, and he gets in the back seat, and he shows his friend a .45 pistol that he had just got out of hock. And then on the way over, no one knows why he did this, he drives through the parking lot of where his girlfriend's father had been working at Kroger grocery store in Crosby, drives through the parking lot, and then he continues on. But this is what's kind of strange. He stops before he gets to the house where the parents of his girlfriend lived, and he gets his buddy to make a phone call to the house and ask for his girlfriend's sister.
Okay.
Buddy makes a phone call, hands the phone back to Whitaker. He listens for a while and hangs up. And so then they journey on over to his girlfriend's house, where his girlfriend's parents lived. They get over there, and what happens, Whitaker gets out of the car, and I'm assuming the opinion, at least in the Court of Criminal Appeals, doesn't say that anybody left the group, and I'm assuming staying in the car, he's driving a white Suburban.
Lenny, remember everybody?
I'm assuming who's inside the car is his former wife and his two children, plus a stepchild, plus his buddy. So he gets a bundle of clothing and takes it up to the house and knocks on the door. And his girlfriend's mother answers the door. He said he wants to bring some of her things back, and she won't let him in the house because at the house she has two other children there with her. And she said she'd been told before and she didn't trust Whitaker, and she wouldn't let him inside the house. So apparently he sent the bundle of clothing down. Then he goes back to the car, and he gets his buddy to get another bundle of clothing. Then they go back a second time.
Together.
And this time, when they go back the second time, apparently the mother opens the door, and at that point he pushes his way into the house and draws the gun. Now, his friend at this point, when he sees this happen, runs back to the Suburban. Now, here's what the trial testimony indicates. He gets inside the house, and apparently it's a two-story house. His girlfriend's mother is downstairs with her little five-year-old girl. And he has a gun drawn on both of them. Well, the mother, of course, begins to beg, please don't hurt my children. Please don't hurt me. Please don't hurt the children. She tells the five-year-old to run upstairs. Well, the five-year-old runs upstairs and for her 17- or 16-year-old sister, a girl they call Kiki, where she was upstairs.
That's actually the victim. That turns out
to be the victim. So what happened when the little five-year-old runs upstairs at this point, and they say he's within pretty much arm's length, he shoots his girlfriend's mother with a .45. It's not a small caliber gun. It's a .45 gun. So then he goes upstairs, and upstairs he pistol whips the five-year-old. In fact, the five-year-old had to be life-flighted by helicopter to save her life. And at the time of trial, when they went to trial, she was still suffering neurological damage from the pistol whipping she got from Whitaker. Then the mother downstairs, who had been shot and apparently lying on the floor, heard her 16-year-old daughter Kiki hollering, please, Whitaker, don't hurt me, and here's another gunshot. Well, she gets up off the floor, runs out in the backyard, and trying to summons for help, and the next-door neighbor apparently was not there, and she's out screaming for someone to help her in the backyard. And Whitaker, after he shot the 16-year-old and pistol-whipped the 5-year-old, goes downstairs, sees the mother out in the backyard, and gets again within 5 feet of her and shoots her a second time with the .45. So she's shot twice, and at time of trial, she still had some paralysis in her right arm and was pretty well banged up. Then what happens, he goes back to the car and he drops his friend off and tells his friend, don't tell anybody about this. And he goes over. And believe it or not, he goes over to a friend's house with another girlfriend.
There's another girl.
Another girl involved. Yeah. A gal named Jackson goes over there, and that's where he's arrested. And when he's arrested that afternoon, that evening, or whenever it was, shortly after the shooting, he's with a new girl at someone's house with their friends, and they're all drinking beer. And of course, I mean, it's one of those crazy cases where he provided his own family to be the witness to this shooting. And so what they did, they charged him with capital murder, and what made it capital, it's a murder committed during the course of a burglary. And they had kind of a flap about that, but a lot of people think burglary means break in to steal something. Burglary means any unauthorized entry into a house with intent to steal or to commit a felony. So their theory was he broke into the house. When he pushed his way in, because unlawful entry, a breaking is really funny. A breaking means an unauthorized entry. For example, if a window's open and I stick my hand through it, although I break nothing, that's considered under the law a breaking. So when he shoved his way into the house, that's a burglary. And the way they proved he did it with intent to murder, to kill, he had a 45 with him. He told a guy, one of his friends, the day before he was going to kill somebody. And so they said it was burglary with intent to commit murder. And that's exactly what he did. He killed one and shot another and pistol whipped a little 5-year-old child. And so what made it an aggravating, the aggravating element that kicked it up to capital murder was the burglary part of it. And so at the trial itself, what they presented on two different sides were this. Basically, his former wife testified that he used to beat her up. So there was evidence that physically he assaulted her. The young lady whose mother was shot and sister were killed, she said during their relationship, she testified how she got beat up by him. And then the brand new girlfriend he's with when he was arrested also testified he beat on her. So he had three different women talking about different assaults. That's where they got the future dangerousness in.
Yeah, because they really didn't have any other criminal cases.
Apparently like I said, I read, all of this in the Court of Criminal Appeals opinion, and there was never any evidence he'd ever even been arrested before. I mean, unless he got some type of domestic assault, but they never said that. Now, that was the testimony from the state side, plus the most egregious thing that I think probably would influence the jury is pistol whipping the 5-year-old. I mean, I think that's probably the most egregious thing about this case that probably spelled his doom. And then on the other side of the fence, his mother testified that when he was growing up, he had one of these abusive fathers that beat him a great deal. Said he fell out of a truck and banged himself on the head, and he had tried to commit suicide several times, so apparently he had some depression problems of some sort kind of that period of time. But none of the defense lawyers that tried the case did not have him examined by a mental health expert. So there never was any testimony at trial that would meet what we call the Penry case. The Penry's when they got a real abusive childhood because, you know, he tried to commit suicide, got whipped a lot by his father, but there was nothing on the nature of abuse that you see in many of these death
and
cases.
The proportion of that's difficult to determine unless you have a professional look at it.
Exactly. And so what happened, the only mitigating part they had was basically the family telling about him not having the best childhood in the world. But, of course, that was offset by the pistol whipping of the 5-year-old and shooting an innocent 15- or 16-year-old girl who had really nothing to do with him. Plus, all of his girlfriends that he apparently had recent relationships all said he used to beat on them. And no prior convictions that I could find anywhere in the record, and that's basically the death penalty part.
There was some last-minute news media about this case, and I gather it dealt with the writ appeal and the application for clemency, because former District Judge Jay Burnett was named as the attorney of record in those efforts. And the only thing remarkable about the story was, or two things remarkable. One, that the only thing seemed to have any traction was that his attorney was a former judge. And the other thing is that the application for clemency was based on information about parole eligibility on a life sentence, and I didn't know that information could be presented to a jury.
The truth of the matter is, there's two things that struck me about the writ, and of course I didn't do the writ, and it's awfully easy to second shot people. Two of the basic things they argued, was about three different things they argued. Let's talk about the mental problem. They were real critical of the trial team for not having him mentally evaluated. Well, none of the writ lawyers, I'm talking about the writ lawyer at the state level and the writ lawyer at the federal level, neither one of them had him evaluated.
There's no professional information in that file at all.
And you can't expect a court to... Well, if I'm trying a case and I'm critical of a lawyer for not doing something, then I'm going to do it to show what it would have shown. And this struck me as being very strange that they would jump on the trial lawyer saying you didn't have him examined by a specialist to see if he had a mental problem when they themselves didn't present anything to the court. You can't ask ask a court to speculate what a mental health expert would do. Now, it could be that they gave him a test and it didn't turn out like they wanted and they kept their mouth shut about it.
Okay.
That could very well have been it. Because I've known of instances, I remember years ago I defended a guy that had just done this heinous, horrible crime. And the only thing I knew to do is to find out something mentally wrong with him. I had him examined. Remember Elliot Chabell years ago?
Yeah.
He examined him. He called me up and said, "Jim, he's not crazy. He's just damn mean."
Well, you know, you're not going to go put that in court.
And it could have been they had him examined. They said, "He's not crazy. He's just damn mean." I don't know. I'm just simply saying it just seems to me somewhat a little unusual that they would jump on the trial lawyers and not having a mental exam done when they themselves, two different sets of writ lawyers, never did the same thing they were critical of the other side for. So you can forget that when you're trying to get a court to saying that the lawyers at trial didn't do something and you don't do it either. Forget it. You're not going to get anywhere.
You
might as well hope the next pope will be a Baptist. You have about as much chance of winning that case. It ain't going to happen. Now, the other issue, and this is, to me, is it, you know, there are times to be realistic about things. Here's the other issue they had, and this was resolved 20 years ago. Back when this case was tried, if you got convicted of capital murder and mm-hmm. you either got life or death,
right.
life meant you had to serve a minimum of 40 flat calendar years to be paroled.
Yeah.
So what happened, they would not, our courts, our trial judges, and our appellate courts would not let us as defense lawyers tell the jury that if you got life, you had to serve at least 40 years flat.
Right.
Which meant, for example, if you commit a murder when you're 30, you're going to be 70 before they even consider it. You're too old unless you can bite somebody to death.
You're
not going to be a danger.
You're not going to have enough teeth to do that.
No. And so what happened, we complained and moaned and groaned saying the jury should be told what life means. Because if you recall, man, back in those days, people do a life sentence and some of them got out. And remember we had that one famous killer that got out. He served two life sentences
yeah.
and got out.
Yeah.
So a lot of juries thought life meant just a short period of time. So the big argument that we all made is that a juror should be told at the punishment hearing that if you give this guy life as opposed to death, he's not going to be considered for parole until at least 40 calendar years pass. And the jury should be so instructed. Well, our courts would never let us do that.
But the lawyers would try.
Lawyers would try. But what happened? A case called Simmons versus South Carolina came out. And what happened in the Simmons case, South Carolina had a system set up where you got life without parole or death. And they said it was error not to tell the jury that life without parole meant just that, life without parole. They'd never be paroled out. And the jury should be told that as an alternative to the death sentence.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody jumped on the Simmons case thinking, aha, if the Supreme Court said they've got to tell a case that has life without parole, they've got to tell that jury it means life without parole. We should, on the other hand, be able to tell a jury that life without parole means 40 flat before you're considered. Not that you get out in 40, but that's where they even take a look at you. But our courts, in fact, the federal court, this all went to the Supreme Court. Our courts have all said that that's required, instruction was not necessary. Supreme Court said so. That issue was settled 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they, from all the way from the Supreme Court to, they said you cannot say it's the same thing. They're not entitled to be told that. Well, that was the other issue they raised. And again, that's like, spitting in the wind, because that case has been settled by the Court of Criminal Appeals. In fact, the only thing that might have inspired them to do it, when this case was first affirmed, we had three judges on the Court of Criminal Appeals that renewed their dissent to that holding that the jury should be told about 40 years. But there they said that the cases are all against them in our courts, so consistently, as well as the Supreme Court, so that instruction is not necessary.
So three judges on Texas Court of Criminal Appeals do not a majority make. So.
Absolutely. And then, in fact, those three aren't even there anymore.
Yeah.
They're all gone.
I bet I could name them.
I name them.
Samuelson, Clinton, Charlie Baird.
And Overstreet. Well, you missed one. It was Price.
It was Price instead of Clinton.
Anyway, Price is still there. But the thing about it, when they did the writs, they really, like I say, they complained about the lawyers being ineffective, but they themselves didn't do what they claimed the lawyers should have done.
Yeah.
And this we call it a Simmons issue, that jury instruction. That's been dead for 20 years.
And so if the cranial damage as a child from the fall from the truck or something could be made into an issue that was never examined by anybody.
No, never. In fact, it was never examined at the trial level. It was never examined on the writ level. Because normally what you would do, you're going to see the same thing. If you're going to claim somebody messed up in a case, you're going to show what you would have done had you had the case. And to me, it puts you in a precarious situation as a lawyer to say, well, the lawyers didn't do X, Y, Z, when you yourself don't do X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
And the courts consistently say, we're not going to speculate what a mental health expert would say. Why didn't you have him examined?
I'll put you on the speaker.
So we don't know. He never was examined. Well, we don't know. At least it was never any evidence of it in court. He could have been examined. It could have been one of those LX or bail things. I don't know.
Okay, Jason?
Yes, sir.
Okay, we are talking to TDCJ, Public Information Officer Jason Clark. Jason, were you participating in tonight's execution?
I was, yes.
Did the process go off as scheduled?
Yes, sir. He was executed and pronounced deceased at 6:15 tonight.
6:15 tonight. So this is actually was over a little ahead of schedule from the normal.
Yes, sir. 8 minutes after the lethal dose began, he was pronounced deceased.
How many witnesses appeared for the victims?
No victims' witnesses. Okay.
How many witnesses appeared on his behalf?
There was 3 witnesses on his behalf.
Do you do this often, Jason?
Yes, sir.
But this was a pretty quick procedure to be over that quickly. I mean, normally we have somebody up there other than a public information officer tell us whenever the parade goes across, when they return to the office, and we normally get a response about 6:25.
Yeah.
But,
you know, once his appeals were exhausted, we moved forward with it. It was actually pretty standard time in about a 10-minute window.
Well, thank you for sharing that information with us. Did he have any last words?
He did. He made a last statement. He addressed the victim's family and apologized for the pain and suffering that he said he inflicted on them and asked the Lord to forgive him. He then addressed his family and told them that he loved them and then told the warden to proceed.
Thank you very much for joining us, and we appreciate you sharing that information with us. And please give our regards to Michelle.
Okay.
Thank you, sir. And that was Public Information Office in Huntsville. We don't normally get that information from that source, but it seems to be a viable plan tonight. Jim, any other comments on this? We're going to do a wrap-up at the end of the show, but...
Yeah, there's one thing this case doesn't touch on it, but one thing's going to be coming up very shortly that I need to alert you about. Years ago, we had an old thing called murder with malice and murder without malice. Mm-hmm. That was years ago. And murder without malice basically was when somebody is enraged under adequate cause. It's kind of like being temporarily insane. Mm-hmm. If I come in and something happens that enrages me and enrages a normal person, I kill somebody during that rage. For example,
your wife is in bed with another man.
Something like that. Or come home and I find somebody stealing a bunch of stuff out of my house that are precious mementos to me, and I do something. And what it basically says, if you're get so enraged and that conduct would enrage a normal person, mm-hmm. and you kill somebody during that, that's murder without malice. And back then, the punishment was up to two to five years.
Mm-hmm.
What they did, they changed that issue and made you submit that issue at punishment in a regular murder case. So that means in a regular murder case, if I'm found guilty of murder, I, as a defense lawyer, have the job of being able to prove that my client was acting under sudden passion, is a word that we use. In other words, mm-hmm. he got enraged, wasn't capable of cool reflection, is the magic words they use, and I killed somebody. And if I'm convicted of that, the punishment range for regular murder is 5 to life. But if I'm convicted, it drops it down to 5 to 20. The most they can give me is 20.
Uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, that was tried here recently. Remember the case in which the kid from A&M cut up his girlfriend?
Yeah.
Well, tried to get that issue submitted as a punishment issue, that it was a murder done under sudden passion because she had dumped him. Well, see, in this case, you have a case. Had he gone over there, say his girl had just broken up from him and done something horrible
to him. Yeah, several weeks ago.
Right, but this was a month and a half past. That was a problem. But see, here's what's a strange thing about it. The way the captive murder scheme is done, you're now knocked out of the right to submit sudden passion to a jury, because if you're found guilty, there's only two options, life or death.
Right.
And here's what's going to happen. There's going to be a case coming down the pike very shortly, In fact, there's going to be, I guarantee you, in which they're going to have a man that will come in and find his wife in bed with another man. He's going to kill both of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that qualifies as capital murder because it's more than one homicide committed during an event. And guess what? They not be able to get a sudden passion issue submitted.
In other words, you can't even get there under this. If it is a punishment issue, your punishment are thumbs up or thumbs down.
That's
you
right.
live or you die. And the 20 years is completely out of the scope. I mean, that's got to be.
Let me tell you what's even worse about it, Ray. Think through this. What they could do in a case like that is waive the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
And tried as a capital murder with the death penalty way, which means as soon as they say guilty, it's an automatic life without parole. And what they can do is threaten to do that to extort a plea bargain out of somebody. Because if a guy comes in and kills two people, say he kills his wife and her lover, that's a capital murder case. And they can file it as a capital murder case. And it's a classic case of sudden passion. And then what they can do is threaten to indict him for capital murder but waive the death penalty, which means if he's convicted, it's an automatic life sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can use that pressure to extort a plea out of him because they can offer him a 20-year sentence, a 30-year sentence, and you almost have to take it. It's a terrible situation because in that case, they would have an instance a guy couldn't afford to gamble to get an automatic life sentence, and they'll use that to extort pleas out of people.
And you couldn't give any consideration of guilt or innocence. It's just not an issue. The only way you can get there is by plea bargaining away everything.
Hey, be quiet. I'm fixing to do a show.
Yes, you are. Hello, Marilyn. This is Ray.
Hi, how are you? I've got my grandchildren with me.
I understand it's a special occasion for your grandchildren.
It is. My granddaughter's birthday today. She's 12 years old.
Now, I've got a question. We're talking here to Marilyn Gambrell. Marilyn Gambrell is the executive director of No More Victims, and I met her many years ago when she was a parole officer, and she was very concerned with what happened to the children of people who went to prison, and she has made that a life's work. How do you know who is your grandchildren because you have so many children?
I do have so many children, but this is actually my biological.
Oh, okay. This is a biological set.
Biological, and I have 700 more
700
children, yeah.
Well, I have always admired your work and certainly your persistence at continuing it. Marilyn, we had a man that was executed tonight, and during the course of investigating the case, we found that he had two children and a stepchild. What happens to the children of people who go to death row?
It's a devastating experience, especially depending on the age. The older, the more they realize what's going on. And through our children, we've actually had two uncles that have been executed who was actually the primary caregiver to the child before going to prison. And a lot of devastation comes with that, a lot of guilt and shame. People say a lot of things to them, depending on what the offense was. So it's just really a devastating experience. So many people are impacted by that act. Not just the act of the crime, but then the act of the execution. It's devastating to them. A lot of tears. We've cried a whole lot in class about that happening to our children and how they're impacted by that.
Well, Marilyn, and in this particular case, there was considerable evidence of spousal abuse and abuse of other women. The pattern of that behavior frequently is that other vulnerable people in their lives, their children, are usually subject to that kind of abuse. What kind of demons do the children of those kind of relationships dance with?
The children that, and you're exactly right, usually if that goes on at all, the children are equally as abused. In fact, we're dealing with that a very similar case today of a child who's dealing with that. And they're tormented by that and how they were treated, what did happen to the victim. There's questions in their mind. And actually, they think maybe they somehow had something to do with that. Children blame themselves. And maybe if they could have stopped that violence and abuse in the home, it wouldn't have spilled out over into hurting someone else in the community. There's all kinds of ramifications. And then if they could have been better, maybe their behavior would have stopped, and then he would have committed the crime, and then he wouldn't be executed. There's so many variables and factors that we've yet to even talk about that impact children dealing with death row issues or life in prison issues. And our society is yet to really look at that, because when they're children of incarcerated parents or children impacted by incarceration in the family, we don't even care what they think or feel, because they're dope fiends' kids or they're criminals' kids. And these children are terribly impacted emotionally from every factor when it comes to abuse of any form, much less it leading actually to the death of someone, and then as a result of that, the execution of someone.
Marilyn, your work with these kids now have gone on for more than 20 years.
Yes.
And so there have, you said, 700 of them?
Yeah, I have over 700, and we're about to start at Casimir High School, and we're now in Arkansas, so my numbers will probably be triple that here during the next year.
How much research is done on these kids?
Very little. One thing that's a little frustrating, and the kids all recognize, is now it's like children of incarcerated parents has become the new hot group of children to get paid for, and people really don't know what they're doing when they're working with this child. The rage, the anger, the cutting, a lot of very impactful things that are going on with them. But now it's like grants are out all over the place to deal with this child. And even organizations that have been around working with children for a long time, because they're old and established, it seems like they're automatically qualified. That by no means indicates being qualified to work with this population.
And that the, what you're talking about is the quality of services provided to the kids.
Absolutely.
But
ultimate at-risk child.
The question I was asking, not about the quality of treatment, but the research into the how these issues impact these children, so that we have a better understanding of what's going on. Do you see any of that going on?
Very little. Very little research has been done on this child and this population of children and what they're dealing with. Very little research of any real depth and quality. In fact, we've had two evaluations done on our program, one by University of Texas and one by University of Houston, that shows that our approach is definitely working, but it also reveals many multi-facet factors that impact this child's life, from raising younger siblings when they're only 9 years old and raising four younger siblings, surviving with no gas, no water, no lights, and somehow keep CPS out of their lives to protect their siblings and keep them from being separated. It's unbelievable the resilience and brilliance of these children, but it's unbelievable that they survived the wounds that they have, both physically and emotionally.
Well, folks listening to this program in real time will have an opportunity to see a documentary made about your work called Fighting the Odds, the Marilyn Gambrell story, and that is going to be shown tomorrow, Thursday?
Well, I heard Thursday, but I've just recently also got a call. It's also airing on Saturday.
Okay, Thursday and Saturday on Lifetime Movie Network.
Right, and CNN is actually coming in with Soledad O'Brien to do a documentary on us for CNN.
Wonderful.
We've been working with them all day the past couple of days. So actually, that documentary, because this the movie that's coming on over the weekend, but what I've always wanted was a documentary where I can really tell
sure.
the truth.
Sure, so a documentary can go in depth where movies are characterizations.
Yeah, and Lifetime Movie is wonderful, but it didn't tell a lot of what needs to be told to America. And this is going to give us the opportunity to talk about that and how incarceration impacts children and families in our society, and the way we handle things in our criminal justice system, how it fuels this fire that's already out of control. So I'm looking really forward to having that opportunity.
Marilyn, I again want to explain my admiration for your work. And, of course, you understand this program is called Execution Watch, and we're on every time Texas does an execution. And
right.
we try to bring to mind the ancillary victims, but also the prison show is still there after all these years.
It sure is.
And exploit us, use us, and keep us informed of your fine work.
I certainly will. And today, actually, you were talked about in the reentry program we're doing for the city of Houston.
Uh-huh.
And the prison show came up today. So some of the individuals released from incarceration were talking about your show.
And Rosanna Ruiz is liable to remember that as well.
She's right there with me. She is right there with me. I was with her today.
Okay, Marilyn, how do people find out more about No More Victims?
Well, you can go to our website, I'm happy to say, brand new, at www.nomorevictimsincglobal.org. Wonderful homepage. I think you'll love it when you see it. And our phone number is 713-677-0148.
Thank you, Marilyn, and have a good time with your grandbaby.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you tonight.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You know, one of the interesting things about working in the not-too-tidy work of prisons is you meet some wonderful people. Marilyn Gambrell being one of them. And strangely enough, a lot of TDCJ employees, Warden Willett, who was the most active executioner because he was George Bush's executioner, a fascinating fellow, interesting, complex personality with not your standard make excuses for his reaction to his work over the years. Lawyers, judges, it's an interesting cast of, I dare use the word characters, in the field of criminal justice and crime and punishment. And Jim, you've been in that business longer than I have.
Oh yeah, I was a prosecutor as well as a defense lawyer. And you know, listening to what she had to say, I've often posed this to people who complain to me about the fact that I've defended people before. And I said, I want you to think about this. If you had to make a choice, would you prefer to have your child murdered or be the parent of a child who committed the murder? And I've asked them that several times because at least if you have the child that commits the murder, you're going to... a good example of that. Years ago, I defended a guy named David Brooks.
Mm-hmm.
And his father and Alt and I became close, and he ended up dying of cancer just from the agony and the horror of realizing that his son was involved in crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing is true, and we don't think about that because, like I say, if you had to make a choice, which would you prefer, to have your child be the one that was murdered or you be the one that reared the child
that did
who murdered somebody? Because then you not only have the grief of losing that child either to the death sentence or losing that child to the prison, you also have the shame of something, guilt you carry the rest of your life. Now, at least you can deal with the anger of losing a child to someone killing them, but when your child is the one that did the killing, then you have that grief the rest of your life, and you'll never, ever, ever be comfortable. And I think, in fact, years ago, I remember reading a story about a prosecutor that quit prosecuting. He was a real zealous prosecutor. And the reason he did, he said, it's not that I feel badly about putting people in prison. Some people I felt put in prison I don't feel badly about. But so I got so sick of looking into the face of mothers, of sisters, of daughters, of children who did absolutely nothing wrong. And I just felt horrible. I couldn't sleep with myself at night. Not because you can't separate a person, like that old deal about no man's an island unto himself.
Sure.
And that's one of the tragedies about our penal system is that we don't give consideration to the family of the people involved in the crimes. They've done the way they treat the people that go
sure.
visit somebody in prison is just terribly degrading.
Sure.
And we don't give enough consideration to that. And there's no way to change that. As long as we have this concept, you got to punish, 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 then you know what you... It's kind of like saying if you're God, you get mad because nature destroyed a town for revenge, you destroy another town. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, and it never has made any sense. Because remember the old famous Gandhi thing, if you do an eye and eye, a tooth for tooth, soon the world will be blind
and toothless. Right.
And there's a lot of truth to that. And I think what she has to say is really true, that these kiddos, I can't imagine what Whitaker's children must feel like if, in fact, they were
sure.
present when their father did
sure.
all this horrible stuff, and there's kids
sure.
sitting out in the car. I mean, I can't imagine what these kids have gone through. And they didn't do a damn thing except, you know, happen to have a dad.
Ride with mommy and daddy.
That's right.
And you know, being a convict,
mm-hmm.
being on the criminal side of all this, I've had friends. You know, Ricky Mara and I were chumps, and Ricky was old dope fiend, did horrible, nasty, evil, ugly things, and wound up on death row. And then on the prison show, I dealt with Mr. Morrow's cults for years. Year after year. Went with him through a heart attack. Went with him through a stroke, or he talked out of the side of his mouth. That you could, yeah, the character of his voice would tell the whole story. Ricky was executed at midnight, and Mr. Mara died before another midnight of natural causes. He stayed alive as long as his son. He did not attend the execution. He was not physically able to do that. But they told him that he was executed, and he died before the second midnight. It's an enormous impact on society. And the cost is more than the lawyers and the courts and the appeals. The cost in human suffering. The cost in the kids that Marilyn Gambrell has to care for. The cost in little girls that got pistol-whipped in stupid, horrible, God only knows what motivated all of that. And the mothers. The violence must end. And there is little hope, I think, that the state... that the society is going to cut back on the violence if the state is so committed to it. I think that the process of executing people and killing people actually cheapens the value of life. Now, those people that are in favor of execution say, well, we must kill people because life is so precious, we have to show that we're willing to kill people who kill people. I don't think it works that way.
Like killing for democracy, same thing they do in Iraq. Same stupid idea.
Yeah, outsiders' democracy.
That's right.
You know,
killing the leftover. The leftovers, the survivors can have democracy, maybe, if you behave yourself. We won't kill you.
Yeah, right, if you'll give us our oil passively and let our corporations have their way with you.
Kill one for Jesus.
Yeah, then you're obviously free. Now, and in that war, you don't say crusade.
That's it. Remember John Crow. Remember John,
yeah,
the
absolutely.
Lawyer?
Yeah.
His son Brad got involved in a situation and ended up in, I think it was an accidental killing. Of course, the jury didn't believe it, and they ended up convicting John's son. And within the matter of months after the trial, and John, and I never will forget, I spent a lot of time with the family and the grief he went through when he saw his son in handcuffs, saw his son taken off. And John died of a heart attack shortly afterwards and put him in his grave. Because he never did go over the fact that his son was convicted for murder and was sent to the penitentiary. Yeah. He never did get over it. And I'm sure when Brad gets out, he's going to suffer that guilt the rest of his life that he probably shortened his father's life.
And John's son, I encounter him in prison.
Right.
He's very active in, of all things, Toastmasters program down at the Central Unit. That killed. And then John's son's got to live with the death of his father.
That's exactly right. It'll be a long time getting over that. And like I say, there's not a good answer as long as we have this concept that we got to punish people for conduct. As long as we kind of work on that premise, it's going to happen like that. Because that little girl that's pistol whipped, killing Whitaker tonight does not make her scars any better, her brain any better. It doesn't do a damn thing to help her at all. What's been done has been done. And killing him is not going to help anything. What it's going to do is do more harm to the children that are survivors. The survivors go there and know their father. Not only kill somebody, they have to go through the shame of having to be the parent of the child of somebody who committed that horrible crime and then was executed by the state. So it doesn't solve anything. I mean, killing him doesn't make her a nickel's better and doesn't fix the wounds that the mother suffered. Doesn't do anything.
Well, I suppose there are no hard, fast answers. The fact of the matter is we should continue the discussion. And maybe you out there in our listening audience can come up with a better answer. And if you do, be sure and let us know that we can be more than glad to support that. I would like to remind you that you are listening to Execution Watch, either through its own website, executionwatch.org, or from link from kpft.org, or theprisonshow.org. We try to get out there and get the words. We would encourage you to tell other people about what we do. Every time Texas has an execution, like tomorrow night, Dennard Manns is scheduled to be executed. And actually, we can find relatively little about this case. So if you have information about this case and you're an activist in capital punishment, get in touch with me. My name is Ray Hill, and you can reach me through theprisonshow.org. And I want to mention our staff. This program is produced very ably by Elizabeth Stein. And Elizabeth has put up an Execution Watch blog. And can you connect that off the website?
Yes.
Go to executionwatch.org, find the link to the blog, and go over there and join the conversation. She was talking about the relationship between big bucks and execution, and that's a worthy subject to be discussed around. Elizabeth is keeping us operating here. Of course, we couldn't do anything without the technical skills of none other than Otis McClay, who is the real wizard of KPFT and Pacifica Foundation nationally. And, of course, tonight we had Marilyn Gambrell on as a guest. As usual, our legal analysis come from Jim Skelton, who is an attorney listed here in Houston in your telephone directory. And Dave Atwood, who was a report from the Vigil here in Houston. And Jason Clark, who's a public information officer of Texas Department of Criminal Justice in Huntsville. And we want to thank Jason for his participation. My name is Ray Hill, and I host these gatherings. And unless we get lucky and get a reprieve, we'll be back tomorrow night. Thank you for listening to KPFT Houston.
The pale horse coming, and I'm gonna ride it. I'll rise in the morning, my fate decided. I'm a dead man walking, I'm a dead man walking. In St. James Parish, I was born and christened. I've got my story, mister, ain't no need for you to listen. It's just a dead man talking. Once I had a job, I had a girl. Between our dreams and actions lies this world. In the deep fire, their blood and tears rushed over me. All I could feel was the drugs and the shotgun and my fear up inside of me, like a dead man talking. Beneath the summer sky, my eyes went black. Sister, I won't ask for forgiveness. My sins are all I had. And the clouds above my prison move slowly across the sky. There's a new day coming, and my dreams are full.